Hello and welcome to this very bare bones edition of Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. I'm Robert Kirkwood and this show is being broadcast around 2 to 3 hours before the announcement of the 2024 Booker Prize. So before we find out who's won the trophy, the £50,000 and a whole lot of new readers, let's hear from every author on the shortlist. We'll have much longer versions of these interviews on Read On over the next few weeks, but here's a supercut of all 6 Booker shortlisted authors. And in no particular order, here's Charlotte Wood. Her book, Stoneyard Devotional, is narrated by Ailsa Piper.
13 mice today. A record. We have to do something else about disposing of the bodies. We've been flinging them over the back fence, behind the pine trees, into the paddock. But they're piling up and the stench is worsening. We need to be rid of them, to bury or destroy them. Not just because of the smell, but because the simple fact of them is so horrifying.
Stoneyard Devotional is a novel about a woman who sort of unsubscribes from her life in the city. She leaves her job, her marriage, her home, and sort of stumbles into living in a closed community of Catholic nuns. And this is kind of unusual because she's an atheist. She doesn't know what prayer is. She sort of winds up in this place as a intending to sort of escape from an unspecified crisis that she's had in her personal life and her work life as an environmental activist. But over time, she finds that this life perhaps offers her an uncomfortable sort of home, but she's grappling with questions of community versus individual and the tension between these two mantras that she holds, one of which is action is the antidote to despair, and the other one is first do no harm. And she's a woman who's always believed in action, but has hit a wall in that belief because her own work in climate change action she sees as a complete failure. So she starts to see that perhaps the women in this place, in this order of nuns, are perhaps doing more good than she's ever managed to do purely by sort of staying still and entering this solitude and silence.
And while she's cloistered, there are 3 very different visitations.
There are. She's sort of living this quite orderly, ritualized life. And then, as you say, 3 very disturbing visitations appear roughly around the same time. One of those is a pretty horrible mouse plague, which is a sort of thing that happens in Australia from time to time. And these women in this cloister have to grapple with the fact that they have to kill these mice. And they're sort of ethos is to do no harm, so they don't want to do this, but in order to really save even the buildings, the mice can eat, you know, concrete footings and electrical wires and all that sort of stuff, so they have to deal with this infestation. Around the same time, some bones of a nun who once lived in the cloister called Sister Jenny, she'd moved overseas to work in poor countries in Thailand, and she, soon after she left, disappeared and was presumed murdered, and her bones have now been discovered and are being returned to the monastery for burial. And they are brought back to the monastery by a woman called Sister Helen Parry, who is a sort of radical activist nun. Some of the nuns there call her rather disparagingly that celebrity nun. And she is a woman of action. She's sort of a troublemaker, she's a rabble-rouser, she is a person who speaks truth to power and kind of has a completely, almost an opposite view of how to live than the women who are in this place do. And my narrator has a very troubled relationship with this Helen Parry from her own past. So these 3 visitations come from outside to really disrupt the peace and order that she has found there.
Now, I've heard of frog infestations in Australia, but not a mouse infestation. Is that based on real life events?
Yeah, well, I was writing the book during pandemic lockdowns. And at that time in 2021, we had the latest very serious mouse plague And if your listeners want to do any searches on the internet about this, the details are really quite horrifying. They take over farms, buildings, and a friend of mine was living out on her property out in the country, and I went to visit her for a couple of days during the plague, and it was extremely confronting to me as a person who's, just sort of jump on a chair screaming if you see a mouse. You can't even keep up that level of alarm because the mouse traps go off every 15 minutes. They have to, some places in the state, people need to put their legs of their beds in buckets of water to stop mice crawling up the beds. They are unstoppable, and they do eat. My friend's dishwasher wasn't working, and her stove wasn't working because the mice had eaten the electrical wires. They eat plastic, they eat wood. I know it's so shocking to people in other countries, but in Australia, this has happened from time to time. But it's a consequence of the changing environment and nature being out of balance. And these are also British mice, I must say, because they're not native mice. They're an invasive species that came with white settlers in Australia. So it's one of the unfortunate long, long effects of colonisation, really. But it is a, I think this speaks to something very deep in us, this horror of plague. And it was kind of strange that while I was writing the book, we had the COVID plague, we had the mouse plague at the same time. Before the pandemic in Australia, we had the terrible bushfires. And sort of almost as soon as the first bad waves of the pandemic were through, we had terrible floods. So there was this sort of epic biblical kind of feeling about the natural world, just these rolling kind of natural catastrophes that happened. And the mouse plague was one of those.
I don't know if I'm imagining this, but there was this kind of metaphor in the mice for your narrator's memories, like there's something gnawing away at her, both inside and out.
Oh, I love that. I haven't heard someone say that before, but I think you're right. And one of the things that I discovered with writing this book is that I didn't want to make the mouse mean anything in particular. Even though I kept asking myself, what does this mean, thematically or metaphorically? And I decided in the end that really I didn't have a firm idea of what that infestation meant. And I've had so many readers tell me what they think it means. And as you've said, that makes perfect sense. Other people have said it's a metaphor for climate change or the waves of grief that come to my narrator, who does spend time ruminating on the loss of her parents, especially her mother, when the narrator was in her 20s and she's now in her 50s. And you're right that the sort of waves of memory sort of rise and recede in the same way that the mice do. But I hadn't actually thought of that until you just said it.
Author of Stone Yard Devotional, Charlotte Wood. Next up on our Booker Shortlist rundown is The Safekeep by Yael van der Wooden, the audio version of which is read by Saskia Marveld and Stina Nielsen.
Eva took up space with a loud restlessness, a bee stuck in a room with all the windows shut. She touched things, talked about the things she touched, asked questions about them. Is this painting supposed to be the Feloa? Was this your mother's vase? Took to circling the gardens with a cigarette in hand. Put her fingers to the petals of shrubs, the trunks of trees. Isabel avoided her. Isabel watched her from an upstairs window. Isabel dug her nails into her wrists and breathed steadily through her nose.
The Safekeep is about a young woman called Isabel, who lives in the 1960s in the Netherlands. And Isabel is quite prejudiced and quite repressed and quite alone. She lives in her mother's old home. Her mother is gone. Her brothers have left for the city. And it's just her in this house. And all she ever does, day in, day out, is just keep it in order, clean, and make sure that every little thing is exactly where it's supposed to be. And then one day she finds a shard in the yard. That's how the novel opens, a shard of an old plate. And there's confusion around that because she can't remember a plate ever breaking. And of course, right, she keeps really close track of all these things. So how can she not have known that a plate has broken? And so it starts with that question and a little bit of confusion. What happened in her family's history? What are the things that she remembers or doesn't remember? And then enter Ava. Ava is Isabel's brother's girlfriend. And she comes to the house with the announcement through Louis, the brother, that she will have to stay there for the summer because Louis, the brother, is going on a business trip and she has nowhere else to stay. And Isabel does not enjoy this news. She tries to fight it to no avail because Ava is the polar opposite of Isabel. She's loud and she is, you know, she has this deeply peroxide hair and her clothing, they're not quite right. It's all badly tailored. She touches things that she shouldn't touch. She misplaces everything. She sleeps late. She wakes up late. And Isabel despises her and does, of course, the thing that we all do when we despise someone is we start following them around the house and stare at them intently. And then things start to actually disappear around the house. First it's a spoon, and then it's a knife, and then it's a bowl. And Isabel, who's already quite an obsessive person, allows her paranoia to escalate. Her paranoia around the house, around things, around Ava, around perhaps the maid. Is the maid seeing things? Is it the supernatural force? And that's the two first chapters of the novel. And beyond that, it goes in all different kinds of directions that I'm not allowed to say much more about without giving away the plot.
Yeah, we'll try and keep spoilers out of this interview. But you say she's quite obsessive at the start. Did you write Isabel as slightly neurodivergent, maybe a bit OCD?
You know, it's a very interesting question because I didn't go about writing her like that full of intent. What I did with her is I've given her a few of my own habits and a few of my own little, let's say, quirks. And then I expanded them, I extrapolated them as much as I could within one person. I made them as extreme as possible. But what I've also done is I've taken a lot of rituals and a lot of things that I've recognized from Calvinist households there. You know, I grew up in part of the Netherlands that's very Calvinist. And Calvinism has as part of its culture a lot of what Isabel shows, right? It has this routine at its heart. It has repression. It has control very much. A very interesting relationship to food as well. Food is it's fuel, right? It's not something that you enjoy, especially not in excess, because then it becomes a sin. So I've thrown all of that into Isabel and mixed it up. And I've had quite a few readers come to me and say that they've either recognized themselves or loved ones in Isabel as a neurodivergent person, which is, for me, I think one of the loveliest things that I can hear, the fact that I've written a character that is part myself, part the culture that I grew up around, and to have this character that just was created by that resonate with people in whatever way. Because for me as well, I think when I find echoes of myself in characters when I read books, that can be one of the greatest things about literature, to find parts of yourself strewn about other people's work. So to know that my novel has done that to a degree for others is a huge compliment.
And we'll have a much longer interview with Yael van der Rooyen and indeed all of the authors on this special edition of Read On over the next few weeks. But next tonight, let's hear from Held, which was written and read by Anne Michaels.
What was the city to me? It was rain. Narrow streets with lovers hiding in dark bedrooms, opening their clothes to each other for the first time. The warmth, the shock, the gratitude. It was snow on the black roofs, the blush of light as it fades, lamps coming on across the square. The chairs carried out to the garden, the table too small for dinner, plates balanced on laps and left in the grass. Cafes, the smell of strong coffee and damp wool, the rain and wet snow on the floor of the mosaic foyer, the wooden door, the brass handle, thick white cafe crockery, cups that have touched so many lips, the friction match of desire, strike anywhere.
Held is a book that spans over a century, and it dives down again and again from a present moment and surfaces decades later with different characters in different places. And gradually, we understand how those lives are connected. It tries to assert a different measure for history. We're used to thinking about history in terms of events and actions. And this book, as most of my books, wants to assert the idea of history as also being measured by our inner lives, what we aspire to, what we value, what we believe, and all the ways the consequences of our inner lives. And love works its task long past the span of a single life. It starts on the battlefield in World War I with the first character we meet, John, who is a wounded soldier on the battlefield. John is a man of science, reason, logic, but he is also a man profoundly in need of consolation. And it is very important to him, crucial, that this consolation not be false. And the book asks, is there such a thing as false consolation? Perhaps there's only consolation. So our relationship to John, his relationship to science, our conflation of science and technology, our relationship to what cannot be proven by its very nature, what cannot be proven, and the whole idea of what happened around the late 19th century, early 20th century, when science first began to manipulate the invisible world, what we cannot see or cannot prove. The discovery of electrons, radiation, quantum mechanics, all this relationship to what is invisible. And that displaced an ancient relationship that we had with invisibility. And so this book wants to assert a value also for that relationship.
Is it fair to say, especially at the beginning when he's in the snow, that it has a very dreamlike quality?
Yes, in the sense that we are entirely in John's mind, within his consciousness, what he remembers as he is lying there on the battlefield, going in and out of consciousness, in and out of memory. So yes, I think it's quite fair to describe it that way.
Now, the title Held, is that held in memory or held in person?
It's both. It's both. Held in memory, held in person, held over time, through time, and all the ways in which nature and the forces around us hold us. There's a scene in the book where Leah is describing the death of her husband, and she says, what can I give him now? She knows what he would want for her, that stillness might grow to peace, not still, held. So the meaning of held in many ways is central to this book.
As a writer, was the structure of the book, the non-linear structure of the book, hard to keep track of?
I knew right from the start that this book would be told in this way, structured this way, and that the structure itself was a kind of proof of something. I understood that from the start, but I didn't know, I couldn't know at the beginning how these pieces were connected. I just knew they were profoundly connected. And so I began that investigation, did a tremendous amount of research into all the forces that bring us to a present moment, the ways we choose and the ways we cannot choose. Evolution, revolution, a gesture, desire, regret, doubt, error, terror, research into the history and philosophy of science, into evolutionary biology, into history. And after quite a few years, I began to understand how things were connected. You reach a point deep enough where like water, rivers, underground rivers, everything begins to connect.
Anne Michaels, the writer and narrator of her Booker shortlisted book, Held. Next on the list, let's travel to space. Samantha Harvey's Orbital is read by Sarah Naudi.
Orbit 1 into Orbit 2. You aren't even the farthest flung humans now, says Ground Control. How does that feel? For today, a crew of four is on its way to the moon and has just surpassed the space station's shallow orbiting distance of 250 miles above the planet. The lunar astronauts are catapulted past them in a $5 billion blaze of suited, booted glory. For the first time ever, you've been overtaken, says ground crews. You're yesterday's news, they joke. And Pietro jokes back that better yesterday's news than tomorrow's, if they know what he means. If you're an astronaut, you'd rather not ever be news. And here's the thing, thinks Chie. Her mother's down there, on that Earth. Everything that's left of her mother's down there. Better to be lassoing it like this than watching it disappear in the rearview mirror. Anton just looks out of the space viewing portal to where he knows the constellations of Pegasus and Andromeda to be. Though his vision can't readily sift them out among the millions of stars. He's tired. Doesn't sleep that well up here, mind too constantly jet-lagged and staggered. There's Saturn. There's the aeroplane shape of Aquila. The moon's a stone's throw. One day, he thinks, he'll get there.
So the book is set over one 24-hour period in low Earth orbit. So the book is set on a space station, which is essentially the ISS, although it's never called that in the book. And there are four astronauts, two cosmonauts on the space station. And it follows them over one day orbiting the Earth. So 16 sunsets and 16 sunrises, 16 transits of the Earth. And it's really a day in the life on the space station. And it's very much a book. I mean, first and foremost, I think a book about the Earth and the perspective that we have on the Earth from the distance of low Earth orbit.
With 16 orbits a day, the human body's kind of designed to be regulated by the sunset and the sunrise. That must really, the concept of time must be really hard to get when you're up on the space station.
Yeah, I imagine so. The books that I've read by astronauts talk about time quite a lot, obviously. And, you know, this, we're so on Earth, so tethered to our circadian rhythms and the 24-hour clock. In space, it doesn't really hold. I mean, the space stations and the ground crews do their best to try to keep that rhythm of a 24-hour day, and everything is scheduled and they are on essentially Greenwich Mean Time. So they do their best to try to make it feel normal, but it's never going to feel normal, is it, when you're going around the Earth every 90 minutes? And that was one of the things I really wanted to try to encode into the book, into the structure of the book. So that's why I set it over one day, so that we have one 24-hour period. But that time period, as we know it, is exploded. And maybe the structure of the book being told through chapters, which are numbered orbits, might help to simulate, perhaps for the reader, a sense of the dislocation of that experience of time, which I imagine, and can only imagine, the astronauts and cosmonauts up there feel.
Yeah, you said can only imagine. A lot of authors will visit the place where their novel's set, but this might be a bit out of reach. But what was your research process?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would have loved to have gone there and been able to research from there, but I don't think most research grants don't stretch to that. So my research was mainly desk-bound. I read a lot of books by astronauts. I read journals and diaries that astronauts have kept. There's a lot on the NASA website and the ESA, the European Space Agency website. You can sort of borrow quite deep into those sites and find quite a lot of archived material, really interesting stuff about daily life on the ISS. And there is, you know, there is so much information out there about the ISS. It's actually very easy to research. It's sort of knowing how to use that research and where to stop and when to let your imagination take hold. And I think that for me, the single biggest and most helpful element of my research was looking at images of the Earth from space. So it's a very visual book. I think I wanted it to feel as much like a painting as it is a novel. And I had on my desktop almost continually for the whole time of writing this book, you know, two and a half years or so, footage of the Earth from space. And I would make endless transits around the Earth, albeit from my desk, and try to describe what I saw. So that was my most direct form of inspiration and research. But then that was obviously augmented with written documents by astronauts and listening to interviews with astronauts and so on.
I've got a couple of monitors here, and one of them is the live feed from the ISS. So they're over Japan right now.
Oh, it's just magical, isn't it? And it, interestingly, that live feed doesn't work very often. Well, they might have improved it. When I was researching the book, it often wouldn't be working. But when it is working, it's just so... it's so magnificent to be able to see what they can see. It's really, you know, the technology behind that and the accessibility of it, I think, is really wonderful.
You kind of alluded to this in the last answer, but would you go up on the ISS?
Well, it depends. It depends on the day that I'm asked. Today, yeah, maybe I would.
Or even one of those, you know, like the Jeff Bezos flights where you kind of touch space.
Yeah, I think that would be worth doing. I mean, I am a really, really unadventurous person. So, you know, it's easy for me to sit here now and say, yeah, why not? I think if it came to it, I'd probably be too cowardly to do it. I mean, it is a safe way of traveling in that, you know, astronauts and cosmonauts are going up and down there all the time. It's almost like a coach excursion to them. But it is, you know, it has many inherent dangers and it is very rough on the body. So would I? I don't know. I honestly don't know. I kind of take comfort in the fact that I probably never have to make this decision. So I can safely say now, yeah, sure.
Sam Harvey, author of the Booker shortlisted Orbital, the audio version of which is read by Sarah Naudi. We're heading back to Terra Firma now with Creation Lake, by Rachel Kushner. The audio version is read by the author.
The road to the house led through dense forest canopy, discouraging anyone who didn't already know the place was here from investigating the turnoff, which I myself had missed while traveling the tiny and rural D-43 upon my initial arrival. There was no sign, no gate, no mailbox indicating I'd reached Lucien's family estate. Just a narrow tunnel into the woods. As I turned up it, a large rust-brown raptor sailed low between trees and the half-lit undercanopy. I sensed it was accustomed to having this place to itself. Get used to me, I thought at it.
The narrator of Creation Lake is a 34-year-old American woman who has arrived in a rural region of south-central western France in order to infiltrate a group of young Parisians who've decamped to this area to live communally, to subsistence farm, and to forge connections to the local farmers. She tells the reader that her name is Sadie. We don't know what her real name is. She's working under an alias and is herself a disgraced former agent for the American government, the FBI, who is now working in the private sector, infiltrating leftist groups. She is blunt, amoral, and calculating, but maybe sees herself as more professional and exacting than, in fact, she is. She is reading the communiques to this group of young people. They have a commune called Le Moulin, just means the mill. Sadie is reading communiques from an elder for the group. This elder, his name is Bruno Lacombe, has rejected civilization almost entirely and has turned to the deep past, the time before the written down, and in fact lives in a cave on his own property. This is a part of France that has extensive underground limestone caves and caverns. And Bruno is someone who has decided that despite his long life as a person very shaped by the possibility, the horizon of revolution, shaped by May of 1968, he has decided now, the book takes place loosely in 2013, that capitalism is absolutely here to stay, and that the only option is to renovate and even revolutionize consciousness. And he is a hopeful person who sees great meaning in the idea of communicating with all planes of human existence as if he can access them on one plane, which is his underground cavern. He writes these communiques to the group that are sort of full of his own homespun philosophy, slightly lunatic, but then again, to my mind, rather accurate. He describes the condition of modern existence like this. We are currently careening off a cliff in a shiny driverless car. And the question is, how do we exit this car? And as his author, I think it's a fair question. Sadie, at first, is reading his communiques in order to locate evidence that the group is planning sabotage of the state industrial farming equipment nearby, because the state is planning to take a lot of water out of the water table and put it in these plastic lined bays called mega basins. She says she's reading Bruno's emails to find evidence of what the group's plans are, but the emails have a lot of questions about Neanderthals and other species of life and how many hours the Neanderthals spent sleeping. And it's pretty clear that he is not advising the group on tactics and strategy of sabotage. And it may be, you know, over the course of the book that Sadie becomes his closest, Bruno's closest reader.
Her morals are a bit flexible. Is she a reliable narrator in the book?
Is probably not a reliable narrator in the classical sense of telling you what you can believe and being the person to whom you sort of cling, you know. She says things in the book like, Italians pretend that different culinary sensation can be accessed through different shapes of noodle, when in fact, all noodles are made of merely two ingredients, flour and water. So we could pull back from that and say, okay, it's true, you know, that pasta is made from flour and water. But her attempt to undercut other people and sort of burst their balloon lets you know who she is, even as it may not have the effect she intends it to, if you follow me. I don't think anyone's convinced when she says that Italians, you know, merely have noodles and that's the extent of their culinary sophistication. So she's showing you, in a way, who she is. But when she presents herself as someone who never makes mistakes and someone who can walk into a room and detect weakness in other people that they themselves cannot detect, I think we're meant to also notice that Sadie is a quite heavy drinker. Sadie leaves loads of trash behind her everywhere she goes. She's staying in a house in the country and fills the living room with empty wine bottles and empty beer cans. And when it's full, she simply closes the pocket doors and starts dumping her trash in the other room across the hall and tells the reader there's no reason to ever clean up her trash because of the way she lives by alias and by misrepresenting herself in order to destroy the lives of other people. She will never return to the same place twice. So there's no reason to be careful or to clean up. I think we're meant to take notice of that and to wonder about the existential implications of a person who doesn't need to care.
And finally, on tonight's read-on rundown of the Booker shortlist, the only man on the Booker shortlist and someone I spoke to this morning, James by Percival Everett, is read by Dominic Hoffman.
My face felt fat and numb, and my hands and feet without feeling. but where I was bitten was extremely painful. I felt weaker than I'd ever felt. If I had had any real food in me, I might have vomited. My head was spinning, the world was spinning, and I didn't know if it was from the venom or from anxiety. I lay still, at first feeling the concerned stare of Huck, and then a spiraling into delirium, like down a whirlpool. I burned with fever, and the chills I was feeling were almost interesting. I saw Sadie and Lizzie. They stood on a little wooden dock, took vegetables from a little boat, and piled them in big straw baskets. Then I was in Judge Thatcher's library, a place where I had spent many afternoons while he was out at work or hunting ducks. I could see books in front of me.
Now, we last spoke in 2022 when The Trees was on the shortlist, and you said you were the last person you should ask for a synopsis of your book. But can we try and can we jump off with your description of the novel, James?
Well, this one is slightly easier to synopsize it. It's ostensibly a retelling of the story of Adventures of Huckleberry Finn as told from the point of view of the enslaved man, Jim.
And you don't shy away from the language of Twain, language we might balk at today. Is that a deliberate choice?
Well, it's a deliberate choice insofar that as I'm a writer who attempts to tell the truth, of course, you're referring to that particularly unfortunate six-letter word that everyone's afraid to say in our culture, even in historical context. But the word was used in the 19th century, and it tells us about the people who are using it. So in that way, the word not only fits, but is necessary. Replacements won't serve.
What did you think of the sanitized versions of Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn that came out a few years back that removed that word?
Well, I mean, I understand the impulse, the sensitivity that would prompt someone to do it, but it's woefully inadequate to replace that word with the word slave. It changes the story. It softens the story. The terror of the story, the sadness of the story is lost. That word does have a lot of power, and it does a lot of work in the text.
I've heard it described as a well-intentioned act of cultural vandalism.
Yeah, that's very good.
Yes. Now, how many times did you read Huck Finn before writing James?
Well, the exercise for freeing myself from Twain's text was to read it 15 times in a row. I learned after 15 times that 11 probably would have been enough.
Did you love it or hate it by the end?
I fairly hated it by then. I accomplished my goal, which was to immerse myself in that world and to commit it to memory. And I'd also completely divorced myself from all of the words.
Our sixth and final author on the Booker Prize shortlist, Percival Everett, who I spoke to this morning. We'll hear longer interviews with all of the shortlisted writers in future editions of Read On. Hopefully this Friday will be a Booker Winners special. Thank you to the Booker Foundation for sponsoring RNIB to make all the books in the shortlist accessible in both audio and braille. And thanks to all the authors for joining us on RNIB Connect Radio. You can get the books from RNIB Library. Email library@rnib.org.uk or you can phone the helpline on 0303 123 9999. Thanks for listening to this very bare bones Read On Booker Prize special. We'll be back on Friday, and remember to read on.